Hello. Oh my gosh. Kita just walked into the studio. My office. I just rearranged my whole situationship because y'all, my desk used to be in view of my bed. And I was like, no, like I need to have a separation of church and state. Like this cannot continue, especially now that I'm like deep into the weeds of like my sole proprietorship, like getting all of my like GST, my PSD, like getting all of the stuff ready for my business launch, which I guess is technically launched, but I'm not doing an official launch yet because, we're waiting, we're prepping, we are careful with the projects we are putting out into the world. Anyway, so I'm in the new studio space, which is my old bedroom, and is now my office. So that's where Kita just walked in. Not my ADHD ass, just giving you a full-on explanation you never asked for. I want to welcome you to this week's episode of the podcast. If you are tuning in for your first time and you're like, what's happening? Maybe go back, listen to some earlier episodes. You can like get an idea for the format, for the feel of it. But if you also do what you want to do, right? I'm not going to tell you how to live your life. You know what works for you, what's best for you. So if this is going to be your first episode, mama, strap in, strap up, take the strap off, and strap in, because we about to get into the goo ga ga sensation. I don't know what the fuck that was. The goo ga ga, the ooh ah ah sensation is the actual terminology. Thank you, Monique Hart. Okay. On that, actually, that is a very casual, agile transition into the topic for this week's animal of the week, slash the theme for this week's episode, which is drag. It's all over the world. It's a phenomenon. It goes on and on and on. Drag. All over the world. Okay, and now Kita wants to get out of the studio, so we will promptly move into our theme song for this week. I realize I said theme song for this week as if the theme song changes from week to week. It does not. The theme song did change from season one to season two because shout out to Kamau, the artist known as Kamau, we were able to collab and they were able to come up with a little theme song for season two, which you just finished listening to. And if you don't know Kamau, I highly recommend you like go onto Spotify and listen to their music. It's K-A-M-A-U-U. I would start with the cassette tapes. That's like one of my favorite albums. There's a song on there called Burgundy. Oh my gosh, it's so good.
There goes my love. 500 minutes till I get home.
Yay. Okay, sorry, not my scraggly, raggly voice entering into your earbuds, but it's just such a good song. So go check out Kamau. That being said, we have flippity flopped and floundered around enough. What are we talking about today? So we said drag, right? All over the world. But what do we mean? Because this is a wildlife podcast. So what are you talking about when you mean drag is the theme of the week? What animals be out here giving you that cut crease, be giving you those 301 lashes, be giving you that blocked brow moment? You know what, TBH? None of them. None of them are out here doing all of this wayward makeup tutorial stuff that you see humans doing. That's not the animal community tea, because when animals do drag, mama, they get to do so because of their innate biological capabilities, not because of makeup. But that's not to say that they still don't do drag. So drag, first and foremost, okay, let's like rewind. And for those who maybe are like unfamiliar with the world of drag, although I feel like if you're listening to this podcast, you may have at some point watched Drag Race or intend to watch Drag Race or have heard of it. So you may or may not know the like cookie cutter, like mainstream version of drag, but drag the way it started was way, 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 way back in like the theater times, right? And the actual acronym DRAG stood for dressed as a girl. Because as we know, what the world is patriarchal and misogynistic in its nature. And so, of course, for the longest time, women and femme presenting people were not allowed to act. They just weren't. They just weren't allowed to play. They weren't allowed to be players in a play. Like, that is a gag for me. Like, only men, only people with penises are allowed to act. Like, that is so stupid. And then, anyway, but because of that, right, they were like, well, we have femme roles and we have women roles in our stories, so men are going to have to dress up as women. Therefore, starting some of the early drags. Granted, if you want to, like, go into different cultures, there is, I'm sure we can actually, like, unpack. There are examples of drag in cultures across time, probably way before Shakespeare, but that's like my understanding of the origins of like dressing as a girl for entertainment purposes. And for this idea, right, of playing with gender for public entertainment. That's kind of where my understanding of it comes from. So that is a little bit of history when it comes to the drag in terms of where we started, right? But where we are now, you may have heard of Drag Race, you may have heard of, you know, drag queens, Bia Bob the Drag Queen, Changela, Monet Exchange, like, you may have heard of the different RuPaul's drag races that are happening around the world, Bia Drag Race Thailand, Bia Drag Race Australia, Bia Drag Race Spain, Drag Race UK, right? Drag Race Canada. And so drag is becoming this thing that is, like, really becoming a world phenomenon. It's used to be very much this underground queer artistry that was a way for queer people to express gender in a safe space through this female, femme-presenting illusion. Oh, I don't like to use female. Through this, like, woman and femme-presenting illusion, right? Because female refers to sex. We don't need to be talking about people's sex when we're talking about gender. So that's kind of where drag has come. That's the background I want to give y'all. So when I'm saying like animals be all up in the drag scene, what do I mean, right? So the example I want to bring up for us today is the cuttlefish. So this is an example of an animal that plays with gender in a way that is so beautiful, but it's also very tricky, right? It's actually done so as a kind of like tactic to, it's like a part of its camouflage tactic. So I'll explain. The animal in question, I'm like 5 minutes in, you still haven't told us what's happening, is the cuttlefish. Yes, mama. Cuttlefish, cephalopodiati. Adi, 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 yes. Tentacles, crazy, curvy, wavy, big mouth, little eyes. Stuffy potty, yada 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 yada. Okay, that was my attempt at trying to remix Megan Thee Stallion's body with cephalopods. But cephalopods actually have amazing bodies, right? Similar to their brethren. Is that? I feel like that's kind of even patriarchal in nature. Similar to their kin, we have the octopuses and we have squids, right? And this family of cephalopods, right, are all individuals that have this really unique ability to change the color and texture of their skin almost instantaneously, either as a camouflage tactic, as a way to signal and communicate with others in its surrounding, and, right, as a way to move through its environment intuitively. Now, I think I've talked about this a little bit on the podcast before in one of the previous episodes. And then there's also definitely some stuff on my Instagram about how animals change color. But the cool thing about, I want to give y'all like a little, I'm going to read y'all like a little thing because honestly, Gagaroni is right, is that they have these three different types of cells. So cephalopods, this is a cuttlefish, including, which is today's, you know, animal of the week, the cuttlefish. They have the chromatophores, which you probably have heard of. Those are like those, like, kind of picture like a Tide Pod, right? Like that just like sits under your skin. And then when you like stretch it out, you get to see like different hues of the color of that Tide Pod, right? And then it's like, if you give your skin different like tension, you can either get like a dark blue or a really rich blue, right? That being said, chromatophores actually are typically like only red and yellow and brown. Typically speaking, those are the pigments that you get with chromatophores. So it's really interesting then. It's like, well, how the hell are cephalopods, cuttlefish, right, doing all these beautiful, ootiful colors, right? We got the purples, we got the blues, we got all these different iridescent moments happening. And then we have to look at, they have another cell structure, right, within their skin. And that those are called iridophores, okay? So we got the chromatophores, we have the iridophores. And iridophores are actually... a similar cell structure, picture like a Tide Pod, but instead of like under the skin where you're doing tension, where you're like trying to like, you know, make it tight so that you can blend out the colors in different ways, you're actually like raising the skin and creating texture. And that raised skin actually then refracts light in different ways. So if you look at an iridophore from the top, it will appear blue because that's the way that it's refracting the light. However, if you look at it from the side, it'll appear more reddish. And that's why octopuses can, and cephalopods and squids, as they move through the water and as your field of view shifts around them, it seems as though they're doing this like mesmeric sort of color dance because of the refraction of light that's happening through these iridophores. Then, Gagaroni, mama, that's not it. They have one other cell structure called lucophores, and those are like, they scatter the light within the skin, so then they get even more wilder colors, and it's like, mama, how did you evolve these tactics? These tactics, y'all are the ancestors, you are the descendants of sea slugs. Like, y'all, that's where they come from. They are mollusks 8.0. They are they're like the iPhone 12X of mollusks, okay? Because you got the sea slug, and then way down the phylogenetic tree, what do you have? You have the cephalopods. Like, how? This was a fucking mood evolutionarily for you to be like, you know what? I'm gonna leave my shell and then develop all these wayward, wild tactics to just blend into my environment. And Gagaroni Maxitroni is that they can't even see in color. They see polarized vision. This is kind of like black and white. It's actually very hard to explain, but it's like, what? And you know what? I was, you know, because I've talked about this a bit on the podcast before, and I've come to y'all today with a bit of an explanation, because I was looking into it, and I was like, someone has to have answered this, right? Which is this idea that if they are seeing in polarized vision, which is not in, like, the colored spectrum that we as humans kind of see and perceive the world in, how are they so good at camouflaging? And this is the analogy I'm going to draw for you today. So, you know how, like, when you're reading or when you're, like, you know, you're scrolling through Facebook, okay, you're trying to, like, get your ooh-ah-ah nostalgia, and then you come across, like, a post from, like, someone's mom that's, like, if you can read this, you are in the top 10% of people who can read this, and it's, like, some weird, like, infographic where all the letters are out of place, but you can, like, still read the words because as humans, right, we actually have this ability cognitively to gain information and make connections just by what we call edge information, or just the border, the bare minimum of what we need externally in order for us to then fill that information with what we already know, with our experiences, with past data, right? And so this idea, this like edge of information that allows us to scan words and even when they're misspelled, be able to comprehend meaning from them and tie that meaning then to experiences or visual cues or emotions, what have you, right? Cephalopods, apparently that's exactly what they're doing when they're changing color in their environment. It's this idea of like the edge information. Like somehow they're just so connected. Their bodies are essentially all brain and muscle. It's those essentially two components. And having such powerful organs as essentially your entire being gives you this ability to fill in the gaps very quickly, even if you don't have all the tools or all the understanding of what's happening. So they see a coral, they maybe not be like, okay, I can see the yellow, the orange, the pink, but they put their body up against it and they fill in the blanks with what they know. And you know what, to be fair, I still didn't understand the paper, but I'll link it in the show notes for today's episode, because it was like, from that analogy and from that explanation, I was like, okay, I can kind of understand, like, you know, this edge information, but still it's like, then do they build up that from like experiences that they either get wrong or get right over time, or do they just always get it right? And if so, how, you know? So there, more work needs to be done. But anyway, I'm trying to talk about cephalopods. I'm trying to talk about cuttlefish, and we're 13 minutes in, and all I've done is talk about how they change color. But it's actually important. It's important to what we're talking about in terms of drag, right? So this ability to play with gender, right? This gender performance, if you will, right? In order to then interact in a public setting, not necessarily for entertainment, but in a way that can provide you with advantages or safety or opportunities that you wouldn't necessarily had if you weren't in this quote unquote drag. So what do I mean by this? Is that cuttlefish, okay, right? They can actually do this thing where male cuttlefish, right, when they're trying to like woo their date, woo the, like, you know, the femme fish, the femme cuttlefish, right? What the male cuttlefish will be able to do is apply a female color pattern on one side of his body. And the other side of his body, right, the one that's facing the female, actually shows like a typical male pattern. So the analogy I want to draw for you is kind of like, you know, if you watched like the season with Pearl, I think it was an All-Star season, and then they did the like half drag, or Naomi's a better example. Naomi Smalls did this better, where it was like half boy, half girl drag at the same time. And this idea, right, of like having half of your body displaying one gender signal while the other half is displaying another, is actually what they use in order to kind of sneak in an opportunity to potentially, you know, get a little tonguey-yungy-yungy, get a little tentacle-mentacles up in their cranial situation. Because as we know, you know, the cuttlefish sexual organs are all up in the cranium, right? Literal brain fucking, skull fucking. Okay, so anyway, yeah, I hope children, are you listening to this podcast? Please be above the age of, when was I starting to swear? I swore for the first time when I was 14. Yeah, I like whispered it in a corner. I said the word fuck in a corner in grade 7, and I was so terrified. I literally thought that when I got home that like Jesus was going to have like told my parents, because my parents were like, God tells us everything. And so I got home and I literally thought, I was like, I'm going to burn in hell. Like, this is going to be it. And I got home and they didn't know. And so from that point on, I felt more confident to like swear. And then it took me like a couple more times swearing in a corner before I started swearing like out loud. So you know what? I'm a swear on this fucking podcast. Okay. That being said, these sneaky little cheats, right? What they do is, and I don't want to like attach the idea of promiscuity to drag, because that's not at all the connection I want to draw here, but it's this ability to play with gender in order to be like, oh, polyamorous moment? Or did you want to have an open relationship? Are you potentially looking for another mate? Okay, if you are, I'm going to show you my attributes, okay? But those who are watching, they're just going to think we're kikiing. They're just going to think that we're a couple girlies at the bar having a cute little couple drinks, okay? Nothing sus, nothing suspicious. And that's, again, there's nothing wrong with being promiscuous or being polyamorous or wanting to explore your relationships with other people. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. Again, communication is key. And one of the ways that cuttlefish are doing this communication is through these camouflageal signals. Is camouflageal a word? I doubt it. But we exist as both a scientist and a thought, so we allow it. Oh my gosh, that was a poem. Okay, that's the extent of my rhymes. We're going to... I feel like I've talked about cuttlefish enough. They are amazing. If you can't tell, I very much like them, speaking passionately about them. And I just love this idea, right, of playing with gender and mating and having this sort of like performance, right, through display. And I just think that it's, yeah, I just love it. I was really gagged when I came across this animal behavior, especially when it came from one of the most intellectually complex and capable animals that we have studied in the entire ocean, actually, for that matter, on the entire planet, right? Because I've talked about this on the podcast, how they completely defy both our socio and our environmental theories of how evolution developed. And so, they kind of get the environmental one, but still, it's like you still need the social aspect to really like pump that intellectual like procedures to really get those cognitive abilities like evolving into your cranial situation. And octopuses said, no, we're going to live our lives by ourselves for 2 years in incredibly complex environments. And guess what? That's just going to make us so smart that over time we're going to be the smartest thing in the sea. Bam. And cuttlefish did the same. And I also, Gagaroni, I didn't talk to y'all about this. So you may be like, cuttlefish, what makes them different than octopuses and squids? Well, cuttlefishes, they actually have like this kind of like bone, like this like calcified sort of like pocket inside of them. Honestly, they're like a peach. Yeah, they have like a little like a center, like a pit. And in the pit, they actually like perform this sort of like gas exchange. And that's actually how they adjust their buoyancy as they're swimming through the water. So they have this like pocket within them that they're like, okay, work. Like, I'm just gonna, okay, adjust the buoyancy. Okay, float, 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 float. Oh shit, okay, we need to go down. Sink, 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 sink. And it's by adjusting the density of this little sort of calcified zone in the center of them, oh, these cute little peaches, that's how they are able to like swim through and move through the water. Yeah, cute. So that's your little intro into cephalopodios. I have some extra content for y'all over in the show notes that will be over on the Patreon. As always, you know, patreon.com/dauntingj. But let's get into 626 for this week, because we are already 20 minutes into this episode and I have a lot more to say. You know what? I'm not, there's no time, okay? There's no time frame on this episode. And none of the episodes really, you know? We generally try to keep them a somewhat similar length, but y'all just come along for the ride. And no one's saying you have to listen to the whole thing at once. Although I feel like that's the best way to do it. That's how I personally love to like get my podcast. But I'm also that girly who be like, okay, pause. I'll come to this like a later date or like a later time. And also sometimes what I'll do is if I know I'm about to be in like a content drought, right? Like right now when I have no shows coming out, I'm just waiting for everything. I'll like stack podcasts and I'll just be like, okay, I'll listen to this in a bit. I'll like wait like maybe 2 or 3 weeks and then I can just binge, like I'll have like a couple episodes. So you know what, you do what you need to do, but let's get into 626. Yes, that's the new jingle we are going with. No, it is not. There's no jingle. As you know, that was a season one phenomena. We are outside of the messiness and we are into whatever this is. So the paper, it was published in August of last year. And if you're listening to this at some point in the future, I guess I should say the date. So this paper was published in August of 2020. So it's now about to be August 2021. Okay, cute. So it's not right now. It's July. That was clear. Oh, wow. Overexplaining everything to you die. Anyway, so this paper is titled Dynamic Courtship, signals, and mate preferences in Sepia Plangon, written by Alejandra Lopez Galan, Wen Sang Chung, and Justin Marshall. And it was published in Frontiers in Physiology. I'll go ahead and share this also in the show notes for this week's episode. But the paper is about your girl, cuddle, addle, muddle, cuddle, waddle, saddle, bop, bop. We said a bottle in the muddle, it's a cuttlefish. And you know what's on the dish? No, it's not a dish because we all be veganish. No, it's not veganish because we be really vegan. We making transitions, we doing the thing. I'm sorry. I will stop with these freestyles because the rhymes are not right. Okay, we did not enter the cipher as we thought we did. Okay, no Pied Piper up in this joint. Let's get back to the paper. So this week's paper is talking about cephalopods. So you know what we like to do? We like to go through the paper. Sometimes we go through the method. Sometimes we go through the abstract. Sometimes we go through the intro, right? And today we're going to do kind of like a combo ombo, you know, like a number six. That is a joke if you went to KFC's on Toonie Tuesdays and got the number six special. This was back in the day when I wasn't vegan. Although nowadays KFC does have a vegan chicken burger option and it's amazing. So we love that. So this paper, okay, it talks about communication in cuttlefish, right? And it includes how they sort of go through these rapid changes, right, in skin coloration, going back to what we were talking about at the earlier part of the episode, how they do that with those three different like skin organ cells, you could say. So the chromatophores, the other two that I told you about earlier. Okay. And so I'm sorry. I just be like in my head all the time and also outside of my head all the time. So it's a weird duality. Anyway. So the paper talks about how all of these cues, these color signals, right, these rapid changes, this sort of ability to perform drag, that sort of half femme, half mask presenting coloration, right, is also connected to texture. It's connected to body posture. It's connected to movement, right? And potentially how these are all connected to polarized signals, which, again, is something we as humans, we don't see in polarized vision. So it's something that's really hard to understand. I really don't understand polarized vision. So maybe I'll do an episode about that in the future where I like break it down for myself and for y'all. But for now, yeah, just know that animals with polarized vision, there could also be potentially something happening with polarization that we aren't able to detect. But all of these things, right, these dynamic displays are fundamental, right, for mate choice and for agnostic behavior. So the paper, they actually analyze the reproductive behavior of the mourning cuttlefish, which is the Sepia Plangon. And they did so in the laboratory. So we like to do a mix on this podcast. Sometimes we do in situ, which means in the field or in the wild. Those are experiments that are done with like wild populations. Sometimes the conversation turns to ex situ or within laboratory, right? So outside of that natural environment. That's not to say that you can't like replicate natural conditions. However, in a lab setting, it's just, we need to make the distinction of where these experiments are taking place. So mate preference was analyzed, okay? And they found, right, well, actually, let's just talk about what they evaluated. So they evaluated the effect of modifying polarized light from the arm stripes and ambient light with polarized and unpolarized barriers between the cuttlefish. And additionally, right, to assess whether a particular trait was determinant for mating, they actually used 3D printed cuttlefish dummies. So the dummies had different sets of visual signals. So two sizes, there was like a 60 and a 90 millimeter one. And they would like raise or drop their arms. And there would also be like a high or low contrast body coloration and a polarized or unpolarized filter to stimulate those arm stripes. So frequency and duration of the courtship displays and mating and agnostic behavior, which is like, you know, agnostic. agonistic. I think I'm agnostic. I don't know what they want me to say. You know how I do with my pronunciation here on this podcast, but we're working through. Anyway, they analyze them all with GLM and ANOVAs. To be honest, I only have personally worked with ANOVAs, and those are really strong statistical tools. I only know how to use them with Minitab, so maybe I'll give you like a little Minitabo demo over on the Patreon. But it's essentially just stats. It's a way of seeing if... So ANOVAs, you can do what's called like a single factor ANOVA, where you just see if you look at one factor and you're like, is there a statistical difference between one factor and three different like categories, for example. So you would be like, is age a significant factor between these, between male and female cuttlefish? That's what you could do. That's for one example. Or you could do a two factor ANOVA, which could be looking at, you know, the multiple effects on multiple factors. There's three-way ANOVAs, there's multi-factor ANOVAs, there's multi-regression analysis, blah, 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 blah. Stats. I'm not a stats person per se. They're really needed for my field. I don't enjoy performing stats, but I do think that it's really neat. Like, I think stats theory is cool. I just think that the math is kind of hard. So not one of my natural skills, but it's something that I just have to work towards. Anyway, so the behaviors, the body patterns, and their components were all integrated into an ethogram, which is actually something I'm trying to conduct with my masters. And so for those of y'all who have never heard of the term ethogram, it's essentially kind of like this big list of behavioral traits that are rooted in like data, in past experiments, in like a lot of sound logic and reasoning, so that you can like try and quantify, right, the different behaviors that you're seeing. And so this is a lot of how behavioral ecology actually works, is by doing ethogram work, or trying to quantify behaviors through methodologies like ethograms. Anyway, so they used an ethogram to describe the reproductive behavior of S. plangon, and they ended up identifying 18 distinct body patterns, right, that were crucial within this, you know, reproductive moment for them. They identified 57 distinct body pattern components and three reproductive behaviors. So that was mating, courtship, and mate guarding, okay? And again, we talked about mate guarding earlier in the episode, which is what sparks drag for the cuttlefish, this idea of like, you know, they're just trying to get it, and they're like, I don't want to seem like, you know, like I'm a male out here, like, you know, just trying to flirt with all them girlies, so I'm just going to do drag, and then I'm going to try and hook up. And you know what? That's how I feel about straight drag queens. That's how I feel about, like, cis straight drag queens. I'm like, it's this, y'all are cuttlefish. That should, yeah, they should just be called cuttlefish. Yeah. I believe that. And if you don't know, like, the queer community is huge on, like, naming members of the queer community after animals. Like, we have, although Twink is definitely not an animal, but you have, like, otters, which I think is, like, a category I would fall into. And then you have, like, bears. So, yeah, love that. Love the little, oh, the wildlife and queer communities we constantly intersecting, okay? Anyways. What other things did the paper find? Like, what are some of the really cool findings that I really want to discuss here is that the paper found that five males showed the sort of dual lateral display, right? This ability to like, oh, perform drag, cute, we love it. And they found that those who were most successful actually had a higher combination of body pattern displays with like the different components of those displays. So essentially, the more patterns you had and the more complexity of those patterns made you more likely to succeed in your like drag, sneaky, trying to find a mate moment. Right. Again, I'm just gonna take out sneaky. I don't know why they have to like imply promiscuity here. This just drag, gender play, illusion moment. Anyway, so those who were able to like find a successful mate from that had really elevated drag, right? Really complex patterns, a wide display of patterns. So like reveal after reveal after reveal after reveal, and you were just like, oh my gosh. This is amazing. This is the best drag performance I've ever seen. Versus those who were like, I had two reveals and both were black outfits. So, yeah, you didn't find a mate. I love that. I just love that there was like that finding from this paper. literally just saying the more complexity that you go into your gender bending display with, the more successful you will be. Like, that's amazing. And then, and incredibly affirming for me. And then as someone who's like trying to start drag. And then cuttlefish, right? There is something that was also really unique, because y'all remember how in their methods, they actually use some dummy cuttlefish. And so the 3D printed dummies, they, is dummies, is that like, I don't know. I'm overthinking that. I'm like, is that ableist? I'll find out. But the 3D printed like fake cuttlefish that they made, none of the study fish actually like started mating or performed agnostic behaviors towards any of the dummies. So that kind of just suggests that like these courtship patterns, right? These color changes, the complexity of these interactions, right? The overall sexual reproductive displays and mating environment is so complex that we can't just replicate it by being like, okay, up the polarization and pump the contrast to 25 and change the patterns rapidly. Like, there's much more nuance that cephalopods have been able to develop culturally and socially over time that have made this such a complex and such an incredible sexual courtship and, I guess, just way to reproduce. It's just an amazing phenomenon. So I was really impressed, not only by the methods, but by the research that was getting done. The paper itself, I'm not gonna lie, like it has a lot of really great graphics, and then it has some that are just so confusing. So I would like, and that's mainly just because of the types of graphs that they wanted to present in their figures. I would say all of the graphics up until like page 10 are really clear and easy to understand. And then past that, it gets a little bit more confusing. But it just means that you just have to take like a little bit more time to like read through it. But and that's also could be me. I haven't ever seen graphics like these before. Like, it's really cool. They kind of had like a bunch of different radar charts that represent the number of body patterns and body components of females and males that chose to mate and females that chose not to mate. So it's just like really, it's these really cool sort of like circular figures I just never seen before. But I'll go ahead and share all of those on the Patreon in the show notes for today's episode. But I'm gonna go check out my cat. I believe he has just vomited on my carpet. So we're going to go have a quick little check-in and make sure everything's okay. And then we are going to dive deep into this week's situationship, because, you know, you need to call me, beat me if you want to reach me. We'll be right back, y'all. All right. I've checked on my cat. He's not mine, actually. I've checked on the cat who I live with, and he just, coughed up a hairball. So, you know, nothing out of this world. Pretty catty, if you ask me. And I thought we would take a second, actually, before we jump into this week's What's the Sitch, to hear from our show sponsors. So, this week's show sponsor is, you guessed it, Martin Bunzo, the author of Thinking While Walking, a book about the reflections that he has made while taking the Pacific Crest Trail. It's a marvelous read for any hiker or anyone who loves nature, anyone who like just likes being outside or like likes getting their ooh-ah-ah sensation with trees, with the beetles, with the bees, right? And anyone who likes to experience life and sometimes reflect on those experiences. And we know if you love like to be, you know, floaty in your thoughts, get your thinking cap on and delve into the philosophies that pop up as you exist and move through natural spaces, then maybe head on over and check out this book. No, literally, like, put it in the cart and check it out. It's like $5.99 on Kindle version. I think you would also get it on Google Books. And also, if you wanted to get it like where books are sold, I think the paperback's like $9. So head on over, get yourself a copy. It's an amazing collection of just thoughts and experiences, and we're thankful for sponsors like Martin because they allow the show to continue and to grow. So thank you. And without further ado, and y'all know how I feel about that transition, but we are going to jump now into What's the Cinch?
So what's the cinch?
Now, I realize that was maybe a touch aggressive. So if that sounded aggressive, I'm sorry, not sorry. I'm so frustrated, y'all. I'm so incredibly frustrated because what we have for this week's 626 is another drama unfolding in one of the biggest parks in the city that I live in. So if y'all aren't listening from the city of Vancouver, which I'm like, hey, how did, I love that for you. Where are you listening from? But anyway, don't get distracted, Jalen. Focus. This park is huge. It's massive. Like, this downtown is literally, like, this park is, like, one third of downtown in size. But it's actually, like, its orientation in terms of the city, it's very much, it's kind of like its own island. Like, it's super hard to get to. It's very much, like, out of the way. You have to essentially go through, like, the city and then go, like, all the way left in order to get to this one little, like, spot. And I think it maybe was an island at some point. I don't know. It's very much out of the way. And so maybe I should talk what the conflict is, right? What are we going to be talking about today? So the Vancouver Park Board says that four coyotes have been euthanized after more than 30 attacks in Stanley Park. So that's the drama that we're talking about today, the coyote attacks in Stanley Park. But this is the thing that we need to understand, okay? Stanley Park is super hard to get to, not just on public transit, but also if you're an animal, like a coyote, who is a meso predator that has to move through a city the size of Vancouver with caution because humans are wayward and do wild things when they see predators. And so coyotes have to have established really sneaky and very effective ways of moving themselves through urban areas, okay? So that's feat number one, dead and done. You already have been able to work your way into this skill set of moving through these streets unseen, unheard. Like, in awe. But then we take it to the next step. We add the next layer of nuance. And what is that? It's that you had to move through these streets, coyotes, okay? Had to move through these streets, these downtown streets, from the suburbs to get to this park. To get to this park that is in the middle, like, it's not in the middle of the city. It's literally all the way out into the left. It's the furthest point of the city of Vancouver, right? So you're telling me, not only do you do this cryptic moment of moving through navigation station as if you are Slifey Slough, and then bam, you find this oasis, this beautiful haven, this giant park. You know what? Let's do a second. Let me do it one second. How large is Stanley Park? Okay, Google, how large is Stanley Park? How large is it? Because we need to know. Like, imagine coming across this oasis and being like, oh, work. This is like all of my hard work. Okay, so Stanley Park is just shy of 5,000 square kilometers. So this is pretty big. That's pretty big. Okay? Like, very large. Imagine being like, oh my god, work, 5,000 square kilometers? This is pretty good square footage, if you ask me. And Coyote was like, okay, time to establish. And this wasn't just one, but two. Potentially three, because I don't actually know the generational overlap that's happening here. So if they're related, this is even a sadder story. But if they're not related, it's even a more impressive feat that four separate coyotes were able to come and establish in this park. And I know before y'all be jumping up onto Google Maps being like, well, Jalen, did you see? They could, what if they swam? You're right, okay? They could have swam. That's also a possibility, is that the coyotes could have moved across the False Creek and English Bay without being seen or hit by a boat to get to Stanley Park. While it is, you're right, it's possible, the likelihood of that large of a swim, I don't know. To me, behaviorally, I don't think that's the route they would take. For me, that's just what I would think. But you're not incorrect in saying that that is a possibility. Swimming could have occurred, just unlikely. But, you know, this is what hopefully my research hopes to unfold and figure out with my ethogram into mesopredator behavior here in the city of Vancouver, trying to actually, one, first and foremost, list all the behaviors that we're seeing happening at these different habitat sites that they're using, but then two, trying to quantify that and relate them to the other species that they're sharing space with. At least that's my work. But no, more into the conflict, right? These four coyotes that have been euthanized. And why? Well, okay. Putting my empathetic cap on and, you know, my trying to move with a little bit more softness right now, because yes, some of these instances were just scare instances, but the ones that have been sparking these euthanization events have been ones where have then been direct human coyote interactions that have resulted in biting or injury. From biting. So the most recent was there was like a 2-year-old whose like head and neck got bitten, and then her dad had to like fend off this coyote. That being said, okay, I have a couple problems with what I'm seeing unfold here. Okay, so first and foremost, what's actually? Let me give you more data. So the director of parks, right, Amit Ganda, told the CBC on like Wednesday or something. It's now Friday. That the conservation office service, so that's like the body responsible for dealing with urban wildlife conflicts here in the city of Vancouver, and the officers there literally just shut down the park. They shut down half the park to go on a literal hunt for these coyotes. Okay, so how did we get here? How did we get, with all of the information available to us, right, about coyote behavior, human-wildlife interactions, mitigating human-wildlife conflict, effective strategies for relocating, effective drugs for relocating, effective tools for relocating, effective methods for de-escalating conflict between humans and wildlife that don't what? Require death. And so this is where I'm getting so frustrated, is because it just goes to show that more information, right? More data doesn't actually equal change in behavior for humans. Right? That could be with an individual level, that could be on an organizational level, that can be in a governmental level, right? This idea that just because you have the data to make better informed decisions doesn't mean you're going to be making those informed decisions, right? And that's what we're seeing unfold here. Just because, right, I exist in this city doesn't mean the conservation service officers are like, let's reach out and figure out a potential solution that wouldn't result in death. And that's just little old me, not let alone the actual, there's like 4 universities in this city with multiple professors who are in the faculties of zoology and biology and forestry and ecology respectively, and all have potentially abundance of solutions that could be brought forth. Right? But then there's the way that this is getting reported. I really don't like this at all either. The way this is getting reported as if, one, first and foremost, the humans are just these innocent people just in the parks getting attacked by these vicious, vile, demonic, demon dogs of death. Like, it's just, It's just, one, the language, the rhetoric, the vilification of predators. Still, I'm like, it wasn't enough for y'all to remove cougars, bears, wolves from your entire cityscapes. No, y'all had to go and vilify meso predators too. And this is the Gagaroni Bontroni for all of this, is because this is getting reported as if there was, COVID is restricted the amount of experts we could maybe bring in to help. And there's just not enough people who are willing to do this type of work. I'm like, lies. Liza Minnelli. Lies and fallacy. Okay? Final fallacy 4. This is not the tea. I'm so annoyed. Because again, this false spinning of this narrative to suit your wayward management, archaic practices that are just death. You're literally just running around trying to kill things, which again, I'm like, such a legacy of colonialism, of white cis hetero patriarchy. I'm like, y'all really love to embody it on every day that ends in Y. Like, even though we have come so far from the extirpation days of top carnivores from our urban environments, we still have that same mentality when it comes to carnivore management. And mama, that it's not the moment. It's not the moment. So not only have they shut down the park, right, but now, and have gone on the hunt, okay, for this, they have, like, the mounted police force in and around the area. As far as I know, actually, there's only been, like, one. But still, why the fuck are you bringing a horse into this situation? Again, just like the dissonance between decision-making and the abundance of information is too shocking for me. But I shouldn't be shocked, right? Because this is actually how these systems operate, how colonial, white, cis, heteropatriarchy operates, right? This very violent, intrusive, and invasive way of dealing with conflict. And it's not even just to say that's like how it just deals with conflict, but it's just like just this in this example, right? And so we should give you, I should give you also a little bit more background data, because I was like, there have been all these attacks, right? But not really. There have been like a bunch of interactions. Some people have been attacked, around, I think, 30 since the start of 2020. Which, again, that is pretty impressive, because it just tells me that these coyotes are like, stay away from our new home that we have taken, and it is beautiful, and we are not moving out. They are literally like they're the squatters I wish I could be. Like, I wish I could just rock up to like a billionaire's like beach home somewhere, or like one of their 12 properties, and just live there. And then when they come, I'll be like, I'm gonna bite you. I'm gonna bite your neck. I'm gonna bite. You have a kid? Okay, good. Like, it's like that, like, it's that energy. And I'm here for the coyotes. And I don't want to take sides per se, but I'm just like, y'all went through so much to get to this space that is brilliant and definitely large enough to share. But of course, humans have to be like, no, we want all of it for ourselves, which is just so wild to me. And then to drawing back to this point, right, about how this is being reported, this duality of demon and angel, of like these death dogs of the underworld, and then these angelic humans who are just trying to have a good day at the beach and walk through the park with their little 2-year-olds. No, you know how many people are out here literally in attract, like trying to entice them, either instigate them with like, food, instigate them. Wow, that's not the word I want to use. Attract them with food, right? Trying to feed them, trying to coax them, to take photos of them, right? And so all of these things, guess what? After a year, if I had someone coming to my door every day for a year being like, hey, it's me. Do you want to do this thing? Guess what? After like the fourth time, I would just be like, go. Oh, no, I wouldn't even answer the door. Or sometimes I would just be like, what the? Like, I wouldn't care anymore. And that's what these coyotes are doing. They're like, I don't care about humans. Like, I'm not fazed by you. You are all of you are wild. Y'all will never do nothing. Y'all will never step to me and my path. We have teeth. We can move faster than you. We can do whatever we want in this park. And guess what? Y'all won't even see us. I'll be right beside you and you won't even know. I'll just be laughing. Hee hee hee. Hee hee. Ha ha ha. Ha ha ha. The new TikTok audio. Like, very that. Because after constant exposure to humans moving so waywardly, you get acclimatized. You get acclimated. You get comfortable and set. And you become bolder, braver, more willing to take risks. Again, this is what? One of the predicted impacts of climate change that I'm trying to push for y'all, right, is as these populations continue to increase in size, as the our urban areas continue to increase in size, as the potential for conflict continues to increase, right? We cannot run to the needle every time. We cannot run to the gun every time. We cannot run to the police and their squad of horses every time to come and deal with wildlife conflicts, especially when we have so much data available to us. No, not on my watch. This will be part of my life's work to end these silly ass decisions. Okay. Whew. That was a spicy moment, but I feel like I gave you the tea. If you want to read more about it, I'll give you, again, the article will be shared in the show notes. And you can always, you know, check out the Patreon if it meets your fancy, if you find it interesting, if you're like, oh my gosh, there's some good content on here, you know, check out the subscriptions. There's a bunch of different tiers from like $1, $4, you know, check it out. That being said, you know, just listening, just being here, just coming up and supporting the podcast by engaging in this way is already helpful enough, and I'm extremely grateful and appreciative for it. And with that, y'all know what the good Lord said. Head on over to IG to find me at jaunting.j, or head on over to Patreon at patreon.com/jauntingj. Now that the shameless self-promotion is done, I am going to go walk my cat. Catch y'all later. No, I'll catch y'all next week, literally next week, for another episode of Zaboomah Foolish with me, your host, Jay. Okay, bye.